Blog Talk Radio.
For that repetition, this is Ralph Point of What's Happening, and tonight we say, Rona, gonna get your mama, or the Black Holocaust circa 2020, a Malcolm X perspective. What would Malcolm do? And when we say, Rona, gonna get your mama, that's black speech. That's our youth. That's the poetry of our young generation. That's the spin they put on COVID-19. Rona gonna get your mama. And tonight we're saying we are our own liberators. And that stands for the Black Coronavirus 19 Holocaust. So without further ado, I want to turn it over to Ralph. And Ralph Pointer, what's happening?
Good evening, my brothers and sisters. What I believe, the overriding element in every situation or circumstance in a black life is racism. Birth, elementary school, housing, health, food, etc. Black lives have never mattered except during slavery and other circumstances where money is being made by our labors for others. The modern death penalty, 80% black, move lynching indoors. The police, as the army of occupation, have taken lynching outside again. And the lynch mob is the racist system, including the courts and the media. And because the lives of our heroes and sheroes who once protected us in our community do not matter to us, the people. Our political prisoners are now dying in captivity. They are tortured and isolated. Only armed struggle can create our image in our own minds as well as the minds of others. Wake up, now is the time. And when I say what we must do, we must free our political prisoners. That is how we are to get involved in yesterday's revolution today. Now on this Malcolm X perspective, Malcolm X said, education is the passport to the future, for tomorrow belongs to those who prepare for it today. Fidel Castro said, within the revolution, everything, against the revolution, nothing. June 1961. Malcolm X, I don't even call it violence when it's in self-defense. I call it intelligence. And tonight, as in every Tuesday night from 9 to 10, we try to educate ourselves. I enjoy the program more than anyone else because I enjoy the education I get during the program. And we will begin again tonight, as usual, with poetry in respect of our departed Sister Lynn Stewart, poet, revolutionary, lawyer, activist, white anti-imperialist activist, she described herself. And without further ado, Professor Louis, our professor, poet in residence. Professor Louis, your microphone is open.
All right. This is a tone poem from way back home. It's a loan from me to you, the guy who sells knishes on the beach, within reach of everyone out there in the sun. Check your mind each time he passes by. You got no choice. You hear his voice cry. Knishes, ice cold soda here. Cold soda here. Hottest day of the year, sun burning down, skin cancer bound, you're frying, just lying around, and this guy is going to try to carry this humongous cooler, ice soda, don't let it fool you, it's heavy as hell, and there's no ice cream truck bell, he got to tell you again and again, Michelle, ice cold soda here. Cold soda here, never fear, your wishes come true, a whole lot of delicious knishes for you, even if they're not really hot, it's food, dude, brought with a song, wicked and strong, he's not no ding-a-dong, he's kicking the gong. Knishes, ice cold soda here, cold soda here. The year 2019, it's not no dream. A man got to drag a bag of hot knishes, a two-ton cooler. It's not much fun, kind of peculiar. This is his fate. Early and late on this great beach of recreation, inebriation, and exploitation, the congregation of untold thousands of souls, young and old in Coney Island. This land is my land. This land is your land. But this guy got jammed, got to haul his butt, about to bust a gut, feet digging a rut, the pain of the strap on his shoulder. Where's the game? Getting older by the minute. What you think's in it? How many knishes does it take? to make the minimum wage, how many sodas he got to deal to buy himself a meal, kind of beat, feel the heat through his feet on the burning sand, just a man doing what he can to live, to have something to give. And it don't take long. He gives back the song. Michelle, ice cold soda here. Cold soda here, it's clear and pure, the sure sound going down of someone doing his job. It's no sob story, better go and make a video from his song. It's right, not wrong. Your Honor, forget Madonna, film this guy. Let his song fly through the world, a pearl, true blue, cut through this life with a knife and give us a slice of the real McCoy, my boy on the beach with something to teach. One of millions under many hot suns across this earth, the worth of every little thing, every hour, every minute, the worth comes from the work we put in it. No limit, days and days to praise those who give so much and touch so little in return. The home fires will burn, Zion's train will turn around. You will lay your knishes down, even if it's only that 1 minute when you're not lonely, when the sun runs down the sky, passing by the cool breeze of night under the streetlight with your girl, all through this world, your moment in time, a clear mind, a warm heart, a decent part of it all, and fine, better to be kind. Forget your riches. Give me the guy with the knishes, a couple of jokes. Everyday folks got to carry the weight tomorrow, struggling not to carry it with sorrow, reaching for our place in the sun where Sam Cooke says change is going to come for each and every one. Respect come round from reaching down to give out with the sound that makes the world go round. Knishes, ice cold soda here. Cold soda here, never fear our fate to carry the weight, but still get over, Rover, got no other way to go. He slow fades and fades away down the beach, out of reach, but day to day, today, it's in your mind to stay. Mischief, ice cold soda here.
Thank you so much for that poem for the everyday working man, and that's what it's about. And they make it harder for that for all of us, because a long time ago it was very clear when this capitalist world couldn't take it from the rest of the world, they're going to take it from us. Ralph Pointer, 1965. But next up, one of our heroes, Brother Jihad Abdul-Mumit. New York City Jericho and National Jericho. Brother Jahid.
Yes. Greeting, Brother Ralph, Sister Betty. Assalamu alaikum, everybody. I listened to the brother's poetry. He said so much. It's like incredible. So, again, saluting comrades Ralph and Betty and the Lynn Stewart organization and all that she's done in her life before she passed, and it resonates with us still today. Just want to give a salute and honor to our prince, our shining black prince, Al-Hajj Malik al-Shabazz, also known as Brother Malcolm X. So many celebrations for him now, today, in recognition. So here we are at his 95th birthday anniversary. He would have been 95 years old today, and still his life resonates because why? It speaks for itself, the impact that he had on each and every one of us, and his leadership skills, his strength, his forthrightness, and speaking truth to power is a model and an example for us today. I was just recently on a program earlier today, and I wanted to just speak briefly about what I spoke about then, because the question was, there were several questions that were asked, Ralph and Betty, dealing with Malcolm X and transformations inside of prison and how that goes. So I wanted just to talk about that for a brief moment. You know, Malcolm, well, his name was before Dirty Red, Johnny Rockwell Red. Just going inside, street mentality, and coming outside, a prolific brother on his trajectory to be a true revolutionary and a Muslim. So that transformation that took place in prison, I just want to speak to that real quick. So a lot of, oftentimes, as I humbly see it, that what goes on inside the penitentiaries and these concentration camps today are somewhat of a mirror reflection of what's happening on the street and in the outside community. So you have strong movements and a lot of revolutionary activity and progressive activity in the community. Then that will reflect inside the prison and it will allow brothers that go in that may not be as conscious or conscious at all to come out conscious and to get a chance to rediscipline themselves. Such a hell of a place to learn these type of lessons, but it is true and it does happen. But however, when movements are not as strong, when they become weak or insipid or compromising or ineffective in our lives and as far as struggling and moving for our self-determination and freedom under these conditions that we live, then inside also will be somewhat of a reflection of that. So, and that's today. And this situation, when Malcolm went in, he was influenced by the Nation of Islam. This has to be a real focus example. So the Nation of Islam was growing in strength and recognition and power, and their trajectory was upward, and it got stronger even when it got out, as we all know. But if there was no Nation of Islam, if there was no movement as such, if there was no organization, then I guess Malcolm would have came out pretty much the same. So what happens on the street, those movements on the street definitely have an impact on us inside the penitentiaries and what goes on inside the penitentiary and how much reading and studying and discipline and working out and training our minds and preparing and committing ourselves to be, you know, active, involved in the movements on the street when we finally get out of these dungeons has a lot to do with whether or not there are movements on the street at all. And every once in a while, even with George Jackson, you know, George went in, you know, with a little gas station robbery. With that sense, he had did about a decade or so, 11 years in prison before he was assassinated by the prison guards. But the transformation that took place under those type of conditions, his reading, and the, relating to the movements on the street, you know, he eventually became a member of the Black Panther Party while inside of prison, and his books, Prison Letters and Blood in My Eyes, still serve as beacon lights for us in the movement as far as analyzing the condition in which we live, understanding the dynamics of prison. But it's all accentuated because of their movements on the street and in the community. So it speaks to us that are out here and the role that Malcolm played to build a movement, to keep and sustain a movement. And it's up to us to really pick up this baton that he left. So it's not just a matter of celebrating his life, you know, and giving acknowledgement, which is definitely all due to him, you know, but everybody that utters his word, everybody that picks up the torch to celebrate his birthday on May 19th of every year, you must do that with a commitment to be like Malcolm, because it serves us no purpose just to be wearing a baseball cap with an X on it and making a profit off of him. It serves no purpose at all. So the call here in acknowledging Hajj Malik al-Shabazz is to really see how can I model this brother, this leader, this father, this husband, this community member, this friend, this revolutionary, this Muslim. How can we be like Malcolm in moving forward the question of our freedom and self-determination in the community? So I'm going to be on the line, Ralph. And I'm just going to maybe hopefully be able to chime in again before the program is over. But I just wanted to give that example how important it is for us to build movements stronger on the streets so that we can affect what goes on in the penitentiary as far as the level of consciousness. And one more thing I want to say is that one thing that Malcolm did that you don't necessarily see in a lot of movements today, because we're always out there addressing the question of police brutality, mass incarceration, freeing our freedom fighters, our political prisoners that are in prison, all these type of issues, You know, but one thing that Malcolm did that we need to think about when dealing with our movements today is how much he was in the hood trying to get our knucklehead sisters and brothers to stand up, get some backbone, and politicize themselves. He was in the hood addressing our own deficiencies, our own inequity, our own misbehavior, our own disrespect for women, our own misuse of drugs and substances, you know, our own ability to shoot ourselves in the foot, to be our own worst enemy all of the daggone time. The nonsense that we have in our own communities, which movements don't like to address because it's all about the people, right? But really, for real, you know, it just is us, and our own unprincipled behavior, our own ignorance, our own lack of consciousness, you know, that a lot of things are not being pushed forward. And when it's said that the spirit of the people is greater than man's technology and all power to the people, well, we got to rise to that. We have to rise to that. We cannot rise to that, you know, overlooking the fact that we have to address, you know, the problems of our own behavior, our own mental health, our own mental illnesses, our own trauma in our community, so that we can be a strong people. And Malcolm addressed that because he was cleaning sister brothers up left and right and setting that example. So I just wanted to throw that out there also. So, you know, you can't, like he said, even though he's, you know, he said it in many different ways, you know, but you can't talk about the goose and don't talk about the gander. You know, if you talk about the man and our depression and that demon in the White House, you know, well, our ability to remove that and to get our prisons out has a lot to do with our own character, our own development, and whether or not we're going to be principled enough in our communities and disciplined enough so that we can do. Or is our protest always going to be with our hand out begging the oppressor, you know, for opportunities to do this and that? So I'll close on that, and I'm going to be on the line to 10.
Well, thank you so much for that. That's a person who knows 27 years in the death camps. He went in intelligent and understanding the political situation. He came out understanding and preaching the gospel of revolution. And I remember, I'm not talking about going back to what was before, but the day of the street speaker in New York City. It was a wonderful moment where the crowds would come on a Saturday night and on a Friday night in Harlem. I was fortunate to become a part of that, and it was a wonderful time. We've lost it. We have to get it back, as our brother has just told us. Thank you, and on again for more education. 8367, Tom Syracuse, your microphone is open.
Thank you very much. I want to read a report that I got today. Quote, there is a powerful force among the people in Yakima, Washington State right now. It is the force of solidarity and collective power, and it's spreading as fast as the virus that prompted it. On May 7th, more than 50 workers at the Allen Brothers Fruit Warehouse went on strike over inadequate safety precautions and lack of transparency over COVID-19 cases at the facility. Like the meatpacking plants that have gained national attention, Fruit Warehouse employees work shoulder to shoulder on assembly lines, but often lack the personal protective equipment and safety measures needed to prevent spread of this virus. The strikers, who say they have heard about the co-workers testing positive through word of mouth instead of from their employer, are also calling for hazard pay and paid sick leave. 7 days later of that strike, signs and picket lines are still up outside the facilities. Families United for Justice, which is an independent farm worker union affiliated with the Washington State Labor Council, are supporting the Allen Brothers strikers with leafleting and the community and social communications. That support has been meaningful to the strikers, but it also helped spread the word to other warehouse workers. At noon on May the 11th, inspired by this strike, workers at the Roche Fruit Warehouse also worked off their jobs. By 2:15, their demand for hazard pay of an extra $100 per week for each worker was met by their employer. This
right
is
on.
A significant win for more than 100 workers at Roche. When the Families United for Justice president left the Allen Brothers picketers to witness the Roche strike on Monday, they were immediately and enthusiastically welcomed by strikers who recognized us as advocates for the strikers. And when we returned to the Allen Brothers, strikers were then encouraged by the good news of the other strike. This is what solidarity is all about. It is contagious. And yesterday, workers at the Jack Frost Fruit Warehouse in Yakima and Matson Fruit Company, also in Washington State, they walked off the job to protest unsafe working conditions and to demand hazard pay. And today, two more fruit warehouses plan to strike. Well, this is a new and welcome development, and this is spreading all around the country, that the working class is no longer going to put up with these conditions, and they are beginning to organize strikes. And we wish them all of our support. I will send this article to you by email. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so very much. It raises goose pimples on my arms. What does struggle look like? This is what struggle looks like. I love it, and I don't want to cry on the program. This is what we're talking about. Thank you for that. Tom Syracuse, the Green Party, New York, and I say the party of people of Tom Syracuse. But thanks for that, Tom. We're going to go on to 7845. 7845. Your mic is open. Henry Higgins, advocate for Momia, supporter of WBAI, political prisoner advocate, the whole nine yards. Henry Higgins, your mic is open. Henry Higgins, your mic is open.
All right,
let's
can you
move
hear me
on.
Now?
I can hear you now.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So I just want to read a quick excerpt from Malcolm X speaks, and he's addressing to Mississippi youth. At the end of 1964, a delegation of 37 teenagers from Macomb, Mississippi, came to New York for their Christmas vacation. The eight-day trip was sponsored by the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee for young people who had been outstanding in the civil rights struggle in their hometown. The Macomb youth attended various meetings and discussions in Harlem. Toward the end of their stay, on December 31st, 1964, they visited the Teresa Hotel to learn what Malcolm X stood for. The following is a small portion of what he told them. And he begins by saying, "One of the first things I think young people, especially nowadays, should learn is how to see for yourself and listen for yourself and think for yourself. Then you can come to an intelligent decision for yourself. If you form the habit of going by what you hear others say about someone or going by what others think about someone, instead of searching that thing out for yourself and seeing for yourself, you will be walking west when you think you're going east, and you'll be walking east when you think you're going west. This generation, especially our people, has a burden more so than any other time in history. The most important thing that we can learn to do today is to think for ourselves." And I would like to emphasize that, because if we don't develop the ability to think for ourselves, we can be easily manipulated. And this is one of the things that Malcolm always encouraged people to do, was to think positively for yourself so that you can act intelligently. And I'd like to leave it there.
Well, thank you so much for that. And would it be that we could create that movement, that emotion, that thinking for ourselves as we did in the 60s? And maybe, as Jihad had said, we must create that atmosphere where this could happen again. Thank you for that. And next up, we go to 3933. Gwen Goodwin, your microphone is open.
Wow. Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
I am happy to hear everybody. I think the thing that was weighing on my mind most this week was the mystery of the coronavirus. And, you know, I've been listening to lots of different shows about corona and still trying to figure out where it came from. I have to agree with Joel that I think it is some kind of germ warfare that happened. And I think that we are not any safer now than we were before, because as the government is basically telling us to don't wear a mask, go back into public, you know, go to the bars, eat outside, it just looks to me like it's almost encouraging people to go and spread this around even more. So I got a video that probably everybody has seen called Plandemic with Dr. Judy Mikovits. And one of the things, she's been really discredited after putting this video out. Not only did she put this video out, but it was also taken down by YouTube, which is, you know, censoring everything that goes up on the internet. And everyone had something to say about almost every part of her interview to try to discredit it, except for one thing, which I found stunning. During the interview, basically, she concedes that the Ebola virus was something that she worked on, and with a group of other doctors, and what they were doing was they were trying to transfer the Ebola virus from animals into humans. And not one person that went through her interview with a fine-tooth comb and tore her to shreds on everything, not one of them mentioned the fact that basically this woman is admitting that we are cooking these viruses, and we are, you know, we can see what happened with Ebola. Ebola was only 5 years ago, and it was a terrible thing that happened. And it was just shocking to me, because every media outlet took a piece of this interview. PBS did, the Guardian did. Everybody took apart her interview. And while a lot of what they had to say was true, it seemed that all of them missed the most glaring and troubling fact, and that was that the Ebola virus is something that, at least according to this woman, was made in a laboratory, and it was made with the intention of transferring it to human beings, which it did. So I think we all need to take pause and think about that, and then start approaching this disease in a way that of course we're not just victims of this disease. And I would take it a lot more seriously than people are taking it. I went out on Sunday. I have not stayed in my house since this this virus has broken out. I've been doing a lot of walking, you know, 5 to 7 miles a day. I go to the park. I really use it. And frankly, I've really enjoyed this downtime in the city. If it wasn't for the reason why it happened, it would have been, you know, much better. But I mean, in lieu of staying in my house, I've been out, and I've seen that most of the time when I go to Central Park that people are social distancing and they are wearing masks. But all of a sudden this weekend, everybody took off their masks, and I'm telling you, half the people had no masks. Some people were laying in the grass making out. other families were sitting in nice tight circles together, eating their lunch and having no protection. And even a friend of mine that I had met, who was crazy and kind of insane last week about masks and staying 6 feet apart, I mean, to the point of, you know, obsession, she began to take her mask off in front of me. And I said, you know, I really wish you wouldn't do that, because my parents are 93 and 97. And I wouldn't want to go home and have something and not know it and kill my parents. And then she went on to astound me with the rationale for why it wasn't necessary anymore to wear these masks. And what I saw glaring at me was this sheeple attitude, and how easy it is to tell, you know, one sheeple and then the whole herd is doing it. So somebody went out and said, you know, that you don't need to worry about this virus anymore on this particular day, and people didn't. Now, I don't know how that's going to affect the population, but I do know that in the first pandemic in 1918, of the 1918 Spanish flu, in Philadelphia, where I'm originally from, they had a ticker tape parade to celebrate the ending of it. And in fact, we had a second wave, and it was much worse than the first wave. As a matter of fact, with the Spanish flu, there were three waves of that virus. So I wouldn't be surprised if we're going into a much deeper phase of this. Maybe I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong. But I just want to say that whether it is a man-made disease or whether it is natural, I think it is stupid to not be proactive in taking care of your health. Until we know where this is from, I don't think it's a very good idea to throw yourself in front of it and dare yourself to get it. And it doesn't take a lot to wear a little mask on your face. It's not really that big of a deal. But I think the things that are scarier than the precautions they're asking us to take are things like Mario Cuomo canceling the primary. This is stunning to me. And everybody better watch out, because it won't take too much for Trump to jump on the train and say, look, you know, I'm going to cancel the election after all. Cuomo canceled the primary, and Cuomo, I believe, is setting a really bad precedent. Now, the primary was canceled. However, somebody took it to court, and they won. But then the Cuomo administration got Tish Daines to get involved and do an appeal on this. It's hard to believe that in the United States of America, we're actually having our elections canceled by one person, that's the governor, and there's no good reason for it, because the primary is not till June the 23rd, and we certainly have time to send in mail-in ballots. It's not a big deal. And it's hard for me to believe that only two people made this decision on the behalf of the mayor. So, I mean, I'm the governor. So I find this really, really troubling. I also heard, and I thought this was going to happen when I saw how easily we were going from public schools over to schooling kids on computers. I heard that the budget was slashed for education by $140 billion, and that the governor's even thinking about going right into teaching at home through the Internet, which I think is a really bad idea. So I think these are the things that we really, really need to keep our eye on. And I guess the last thing I want to say is, don't be surprised if you find yourself walking, you know, in the same group as somebody who is in the KKK. And I say that not because I agree with anything they're saying, but I think at some point we're going to find ourselves out on the streets protesting a lot of these things that are happening. Now, they came to the table, basically, they come to the table to corrupt any kind of organization that is rising up through the lockdown. They're going to exploit it and try to get in front of it so that they can bring their racial crap into it. But at some point, we're going to have to rise up against these draconian measures that are being put upon us through the government. And I'm not talking about lockdowns. I'm talking about taking away primaries, taking away public school. And I will wrap it up and leave it there for this week. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that. Gwen Goodwin, our person on the street, who's working like heck to make the world a better place and to end the corruption in politics. Sister Betty.
I want to call attention to something Malcolm said, and I want you to take it within the context of what Sister Gwen Goodwin and what Brother Jihad just said to us. Malcolm said, the media is the most powerful entity on earth. They have the power to make the innocent guilty and to make the guilty innocent, and that's power, because they control the minds of the masses. Malcolm X, circa February 10th to, I don't have the exact date, but this is a quote from Malcolm X, and this is what our program is about, metaphysical imperialism. While we are focusing on COVID-19 and staying home as decent, good Negroes, when we step into the streets, as Malcolm said at the beginning of this program, they start whipping on our heads. They start tasering us while we have children. They're coming into our houses and shooting us dead by mistake, allegedly.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know your history, if you're not paying attention to what happened in Germany to the Jews and to the communists and to the workers in 1927, in 1928, in 1929, and then it was too late because by that time Hitler had a foot in the Reichstag, and then the Reichstag was burned. Well, Lynn Stewart always said, it's not going to come to us the way it came in Germany. It's going to come legal. They're going to pass a law and say, oh, we're so concerned about you. It's going to be legal. There will be no primary today. And then the next thing you know, there will be no presidential election. Not that it matters. If it's between Biden and Trump, it doesn't matter. But what matters is that we have the job to educate, educate, educate. And that's what this program is about. So before we get to Sister Ann Lamb, we want to go to Dr. Kelly Harris, who's in charge of the Black Studies program at Seton Hall in New Jersey. And we want to listen to this very young brother, and he is a very young brother, talk to us tonight in terms of his thoughts on Malcolm, the movement, and the Black Holocaust, and whatever else he wants to say. And we're leaving open your mics. As long as we don't hear an echo, after each speaker, we welcome your comments. Because all of these dots do connect. What Tom said connects to what Brother Jihad said. What Sister Gwen said connects to what Dr. Kelly's going to say. And definitely what Brother Henry Hagen said is going to connect to what everybody is thinking. So we got a lot of good speakers waiting. We got Brother Gil in the wings, and we got Sister Ann out there. So we want you to hang in there. Dr. Kelly, your mic is open, and thank you, because we know you had a big speaking engagement, Zoom-like, for Malcolm, and we're glad you had time to come to us.
Dr. Kelly,
you so
your phone is open.
Yeah, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you.
Okay, thank you, Brother Ralph, and thank you, Sister Betty. Thank you so much for having me on and allowing me to say a few words about Brother Malcolm, someone whom I dearly respect. And I want to actually pick up, Sister Betty, what you just said about connecting the dots, because I think that's very important for us when we think about Brother Malcolm and what he means to us. So, you know, he comes into the world in 1925, but we have to remember, and I said this tonight, one of the things that's not well known about Malcolm, before he was incarcerated, even during the time he was hustling in New York, he came into contact with Vicki Garvin and with Queen Mother Moore. And, you know, Vicki Garvin in particular talked about how astute Malcolm was and how sharp he was, and she was recruiting him to be in the Communist Party. So he wasn't an empty vessel when he went to prison. But Malcolm also was growing in an environment in New York where you had the Council on African Affairs with Paul Robeson and Alpheus Hutton and W.E.B. Du Bois. You had that atmosphere when people of African descent in America were aligning themselves and working for the liberation of Africa. Malcolm was exposed to that. He clearly was exposed to it when he came out of prison in the 1950s. And so that's one of the things I want to talk about in terms of connecting these dots. You had so many people. So when we look at Malcolm or any individual figure, we always have to connect the dots to the movements that they were exposed to and the people that they were exposed to, everyday people who did so much work in helping them to develop. Because a lot of people don't know about Vicki Garvin, but she was a great organizer, she did a great contribution for the Communist Party. Another person some people don't know, Claudia Jones. She's also someone else that we need to talk about when in connecting those dots. We need to talk about is Londa Robeson and her contribution, not just Paul, but his wife as well. So this is the environment that Malcolm came into and that he was learning from people like this during this time. And we also had to be mindful that the attack against Malcolm did not start late in his life. Those things started right while he was still incarcerated. We know that in September 1952, the FBI had letters that Malcolm had written while he was in prison. He still was in prison in September 1952, and the FBI had letters that he had written. How did they get them? Why did they get them? I am of the impression that they probably had him, he probably came to their attention when he was in New York before he went to prison, going to these communist meetings and talking to Vicki Garvin. He probably was already under suspicion. And that's some of the things that I think that we really have to look at. But what world did he come into in terms of once he got out of prison? The United States already had that Cold War imperative. The United States was intent on controlling leadership all around the world, intent on keeping people out of the Soviet sphere of influence, but also intent on having access and control over strategic resources. So we know about Guatemala. We know about Iran, what the CIA did that. We know that in Ghana, the CIA was in Ghana before Kwame Nkrumah even came to power. We know once he came to power that the CIA was recruiting Ghana's finance minister, K. Abedema. And they recruited a labor organizer, Tom Mboya. We know that. We know that when Tom Mboya sent students to the United States, of which Barack Obama's father was one of them, he sent students to the United States, that money came from the Kennedys. We know that. So we know that they wanted to control the burgeoning African leadership. We know that. We know that there was an organization dedicated to African Society for African Culture. We know that the CIA put somebody in to run that organization, James Chet Harris, a black man. We know that. We know that the CIA was concerned with, not CIA, the United States government was concerned about African Americans developing strong linkages with African liberation movement and African governments. We know that the CIA, the United States government, did not want that to happen. So we know that Malcolm X, being a strong voice, being a clear voice, posed a significant challenge to the United States strategic interests as it pertains to Africa. And I think that that's something that we cannot forget, because when we look at what happened to African leaders, we look at the people who were decimated by the CIA and these counterintelligence programs of the FBI and other U.S. intelligence agencies. When we look at Kwame Nkrumah, when we look at Amir Carl Cabral, when we look at Che Guevara, when we look at Patrice Lumumba, when we look at Medgar Evers, when we look at Malcolm X, when we look at Dr. King, when we look at Claudia Jones, when we look at the Robesons, when we look at the Du Boises, when we look at all these people whose lives were torn asunder because of these counterintelligence tactics of the United States government, and we can get into, we haven't even mentioned the Black Panther Party and all these other liberation movements and struggles here. We haven't even got to that. But when we look at all these things that were decimated because of that, we look at the leadership now that's in Africa, we know that they did their job. And we have to do a lot of work to change that around, to turn that around, because we had momentum when Malcolm was at his height in the 50s and the 60s, and other people were at that height. We had some momentum, but that was taken from under us. You know, I mentioned tonight on the Zoom meeting, well, one of the things that we really have to do when we're fighting and trying to get justice for, when we're talking about prison, the prison abolishment movement, abolishing prison, when we're talking about that, which is important, we also need to hold this country accountable for what they've done. Dwight Eisenhower was an assassin. Eisenhower himself said, we need to dispose of Patrice Lumumba. When we're talking about reparations, we should be talking about reparations for the Congo. We should be talking about reparations for Ghana. We should be talking about reparations for the families who, that were destroyed by the U.S. government saying it was in our best strategic interest to get rid of these people. We should be talking about that. We should hold them accountable. We should have a brother mention a people's tribunal about the impact of COVID-19. And I said, well, we need a people's tribunal on the FBI and the CIA and what they've done to that. So if we really want to, I think, remember Malcolm and honor Malcolm, we have to hold these government intelligence agencies accountable for what they've done and the lives that they destroyed and the movements that they've destroyed and the people that they've destroyed. And that's the only way I think that we can really grapple with who he was and what the other people were, because we have to connect those dots, like Sister Betty said.
Well, thank you so much for that. And you give me great heart, because the thing about Malcolm X, and I was there, he was able to adapt to the situation. He went from street to religion to internationalism to all of these things, what was real, and he was able to communicate with the people. And as you say, we must create that environment in the street in which people can grow. And I'm, what would you say? I'm uplifted, a young man like yourself, teaching young people at the university to create that situation. I've seen it, and it's happening. We must catch up again. Sister Betty.
I just want to thank everybody who is on tonight, and I do appreciate you so much, Dr. Kelly Harris. Makes me feel good to see the next generation come along. And I want people to remember what Brother Jihad said. We got to work on ourselves. Malcolm said that too. Malcolm definitely said that. I saw Brother Dr. Harris was talking about reparations. I want to turn to a group and a spokesman for the group that was out protesting in terms of reparations. Brother Gil, your mic is open, but please be mindful. Want to get Sister Ann on. She's the heart of this show, because she's talking about the death camp. And ultimately, if we can't free our people from the death camp, then we don't deserve to call ourselves revolutionaries. Brother Gil, your mic is open.
I'll be brief. I didn't know Ho Chi Minh or Malcolm X, so I'm just here to listen today.
Okay. But we want to thank you for your protest to make the rich pay their reparations. But the girl was involved in a car caravan that took it to the elites. What elite strongholds did you storm a Saturday?
This Saturday we went to J.P. Morgan Chase World Headquarters at 47th Street in Vanderbilt, where we shall return with more. And we also went up to Jamie Dimon's apartment on Park Avenue and 93rd Street.
Right. All right. Thank you.
We have plenty of other actions, future actions, and if you want to get involved in helping plan those and execute those, come find us at the Uhuru Solidarity Movement.
Thank you, and thank you for your solidarity. Sister Ann Lamb, your mic is open.
All right, thank you so much, Sister Betty. Always an honor to be in your company, and Ralph's and other everybody else on this show. I just wanted to say, I was remembering, in one of our Jericho National conferences, we were actually in Omaha, and we were at the site where Malcolm was born. The house is no longer there because they were attacked by the Klan when he was only a month old, and they burned it to the ground. But it's interesting because, you know, his dad and his mom were very active in Marcus Garvey, you know, at the UNIA. So, you know, his dad used to preach on street corners. So he didn't get it from nowhere, you know. He has a history in his family. But it's amazing that they do have the site of his house out in Omaha. You were there with a group of people who take care of it and everything else. There's a whole nice plaque. It was really nice to see. You know, you admire Malcolm X, but what I was saying the other day, I said to Jihad, I said the best way we can remember Malcolm X is to be like Malcolm. You know, I think if we all tried more to be like Malcolm, we'd be in a much better place than where we are now. So that's just one little thing short about Malcolm, who I always admired and loved. And, you know, it was a great thing to be in his place. Here's a nice little quote from Malcolm, which I always liked, and it's very appropriate to this time. The media is the most powerful entity on earth. They have the power to make the innocent guilty and to make the guilty innocent. And that's power, because they control the minds of the masses.
Thank you, Ann. I said that. So great minds think alike. I really appreciate that. Yeah.
Okay.
Listen, I guess Joel is on also. So we'd like to leave a few moments to let Joel take us home. So continue, Ann. Give us statistics.
I'll be quick. I got some sad news today. I think people know Francis Golden, the publisher, you know, who worked so intensely with Mumia. She has passed. Yeah, so that's some sad news. There's a lovely tribute to her. I'll be sending it out, including one from Mumia. And then, of course, we have the horrible COVID-19 jail and prisons report, which I have to really thank its UCL law people. They've done a tremendous job. All right. So we have confirmed cases of residents in prisons, jails, and federal prisons throughout the country, and we know this is a mad undercount, 31,100, and confirmed deaths of residents, 419, okay? So this has been going up every day. You know, we've been running around the state trying to get Cuomo to do something about these things. Now, at least minimally, one would say, since he's busy saying, you know, we have more testing sites than are being used, well then, why don't you at the very least test every single prisoner in the state? It would be very easy for them to do that. Now, you know, they're not really testing people until they're already sick. So, you know, they have no idea really how many people they have with COVID and don't have with COVID in the different prisons throughout the state. You know, and until somebody gets sick, then they say, oh, they're sick. Oh, they must have it. You know, now we'll test them. Should be testing everybody. So many people don't have symptoms and, you know, test positive. So that's just minimally what he could do. Yes.
And I'm going to have to go to who told us several weeks ago, months ago, that this was a plandemic. And it's coming out now, and you're going to hear more about it in the next couple of days. But we have to give Joel a shot before we put him on. Joel, your mic.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you.
Can you hear me?
And
yes,
we'll start with you next week. We'll start with you.
Excuse me?
Go ahead, Joel.
Yes. Well, we're really all under the gun now. And now it's been reported that somehow this pandemic, whatever it is taking a shape where the more, it looks like the more melanin a population has, the more heavily pandemic is taking people's lives, a much larger percentage per capita, and even in absolute numbers. And then we have the police making arrests. They say 80% of the arrests for not taking the proper precautions, like not wearing masks, getting too close, is people of color, and especially black people. And so we have two sides of the war of the state against the oppressed going on, and we have the entire country extending now from the prisons to be like one big prison. And of course, it's all for our own good because after all, they have to protect us against the pandemic that they started in the first place. So I think that it's a time when people have to become conscious. The precautions that we're urged to take, the masks, the distancing, the gloves, this might help slow down the infection rate and the death rate to a small degree. But the only way that we can make sure that anything like this is stopped completely and doesn't have a repeat performance in any way, and this is a repeat performance, For example, on the pandemic tape, Judy Mikovits admits that she was involved in transforming viruses from animal viruses to the Ebola virus, which can affect humans. And then it was spread all over Africa. I don't know how many thousands or hundreds of thousands of people were murdered by that disease. She also was involved in a rivalry between between Fauci and a French biomedical researcher.
Thank you for that. We're going to have to start next week where you left off, because there is so much more to this plandemic that's coming on. And it starts with they planned for the economic fighting of this a year ago.
We want to thank our special guests, Brother Jihad and Dr. Kelly Harris. We hope that when you have time in your schedule, you will return again. We want to thank all of you for being a part of the program. Good night, and what would Malcolm X do?
Malcolm X would continue to educate himself as we are educating ourselves. Good night, my brothers and sisters. Love you all. Thank you for coming.
Remove all the bars that keep